Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity once again today, as Jim has been on vacation this week. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, we have bad, we have crazy martinis today, and something special. We needed a positive splash for the end of the week, and we think we certainly have the right story for that to briefly discuss at the end. But let's begin with the good martini. But before we really get into the first or the second or the third martinis, I just want to point out a new Gallup poll, Ian, that shows that the favorability ratings for both of the major party presidential candidates are below 40%. They're back to pre-convention levels. Donald Trump at 32%, Hillary Clinton at 39%, which is about 39% too high. But the reason the American people don't like either one of these people will be highly profiled in today's Three Martini Lunch, starting with Mrs. Clinton. The Daily Caller gets credit for breaking this story. Multiple FBI investigations are underway involving potential corruption charges against the Clinton Foundation, according to a former senior law enforcement official. The investigation centers on New York City, where the Clinton Foundation has its main offices, according to the former official who has direct knowledge of the activities. Prosecutorial support will come from various U.S. attorneys' offices, a major departure from other centralized FBI investigations. So if you're thinking, I just heard earlier this week that the Justice Department said they're not going to even allow an investigation into this. Well, that story is true, but this is now FBI working in conjunction with U.S. attorneys. And one in particular gives at least some conservatives reason to think that this will be something other than a big to-do about nothing. Here's Jazz Shaw over at Hot Air. Now, I know what you're thinking. Why bother? Even if they turn up anything, the DOJ will just toss it into the trash, the same as they did with Huma Abedin's embezzlement charges, right? Nobody could blame you for thinking that, but in this case, you just may turn out to be wrong. The reason for that is the name of the individual who kicked this thing off in the Empire State in the first place, Preet Bharara. If you're not familiar with him, the man is absolutely fearless when it comes to persons of political power and maintains a reputation for the apolitical pursuit of justice generally only applied to the movie version of Elliot Ness. He's knee-deep into multiple investigations of corruption by New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, while simultaneously digging through the offices of Governor Andrew Cuomo himself, as well as the entire executive branch of state government. He produces results, too. He's already taken down the Republican state Senate majority leader and the Democratic Speaker of the Assembly, a guy who was considered the most powerful man in state government for decades. So, Ian, there is reason for some optimism there, but taking down Sheldon Silver is a little bit different than taking down the Clinton Foundation and Hillary Clinton. Skepticism is probably warranted here, but the fact that some people actually want to pursue justice in the federal government is reason to celebrate today.
The story earlier this week that the DOJ had effectively spiked the FBI's request for an investigation gave the lie to, well, further gave the lie, I suppose, to Loretta Lynch's declaration that she would, you know, follow the FBI, whatever they recommended. Of course, that was never going to happen, and it already turns out to have been the case that they were not going to pursue it, at least on the foundation side, you know, as opposed to the email side. Obviously, this is going to be a case of wait and see, but look, Bharara has made his name in New York and to a certain extent across the nation because of his work here prosecuting public corruption. There's no bigger target on public corruption than the Clintons. So we'll have to wait and see, but it is encouraging news. And assuming all of this is correct, all of the news that we're hearing, it's not only that it's reassuring that there are people in the federal government who want to pursue these investigations, as you say, Greg, but it probably speaks to the certainty or the conviction that these FBI officials have that there's something untoward going on here. We in the press have a variety of information where we can draw our conclusions, but we're always sort of dealing with gaps and absences. In the FBI, presumably they're not, or they're dealing with far fewer of them. So for the FBI to have this investigation spiked by the DOJ, but then continue to pursue it elsewhere, suggests to me, again, assuming that all of this is accurate, that there are some people in the organization who are pretty convinced there's something improper, illegal, et cetera, going on here.
We'll certainly find out. But given all those other investigations, I don't know how far along they are in this probe, and it's probably unlikely we'd see anything before the election since we're now less than 3 months away. But you never know how the office will prioritize these things. But there's a lot of interlocking parts here, a lot of tangled webs when it comes to the Clinton Foundation and following the money. They do a very good job of hiding things, although apparently not good enough, because there's a lot of people who have figured out their strategy on this. But let's move to the second martini now, Ian. And Donald Trump is, according to most polls, losing either by a little bit, a moderate amount, or a lot in national polls. And some of the state polls are kind of the same way. The electoral map was always going to be difficult for the Republican nominee. And with Trump, it appears to be more difficult than perhaps another nominee. But the closer we get to Election Day, the more other people are getting nervous about other races down the ballot. And we have three different stories here to kind of highlight how this theoretically could be a perfect storm if Trump either doesn't shape up his act or Hillary doesn't get indicted for something else along the way. Here's from The Blaze. This is the U.S. Senate and Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, talking. McConnell did not mention Trump as being a drag on the Republican down-ballot races, but he chided Trump's campaign tactics. The Kentucky senator said he hopes Trump, quote, settles down and follows the script, unquote. When asked by a reporter about Trump's comments labeling President Obama as the founder of the Islamic State, McConnell replied, I'm hoping that we can make this election about Hillary Clinton. If we do, we can win. With the election less than 3 months away, McConnell said Republicans are in a dogfight and listed GOP-held seats in New Hampshire, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Florida, and Indiana as, quote, unquote, very competitive. He followed that up by saying, I may or may not be calling the shots next year. When it comes to the House, Larry Sabato from the University of Virginia and his crystal ball reports this week with his colleague Kyle Condick, this week we're moving four House race ratings towards the Democrats. That brings the overall House tally to 226 safe, likely, or leaning Republican seats, 193 safe, likely, or leaning Democratic seats, and 16 toss-ups, 14 of which are held by Republicans. The House is currently 247 to 188, so if you split the toss-ups, the Republicans would still have 234 seats. But even Paul Ryan apparently is letting folks know that maintaining the House majority is not necessarily a guarantee. And if that weren't enough, The Atlantic reporting, Trump's name atop the GOP ticket has prompted Democrats and their allies to set their sights higher for state legislative races this fall. With more states in play, they are now aiming to flip at least 10 and as many as 13 legislative chambers. If they accomplish that, they would have complete control of the governments in Colorado, Minnesota, and Washington State, while breaking the GOP's one-party rule in Michigan, Maine, and even Florida. So, Ian, obviously we have a long way to go. A lot of this might not happen. It would really take a perfect storm, especially for the Democrats to take the House. But the point here is that the Republican nominee is not helping, it seems, anywhere.
No, absolutely not. And I mean, this has been one of the more interesting things to watch as the season's gone on. And about a month ago, we were able to say, looking at the polls, there was some sort of surprising ticket splitting going on where it seemed like Trump was not affecting these down ballot races. And over the past month, that's reversed. And it's become very clear that he's presenting a drag. To start with the Senate, look, the Senate map was already bad. There's no question about that. But now you look at it and you have New Hampshire and Ohio and Wisconsin all basically neck and neck, or the Republican losing. The only state where Republicans have a chance of picking up a Senate seat is Nevada, where Joe Heck hopes to take Harry Reid's seat, and that race is a dead heat. So we knew that the Senate was going to be tough, but Trump is, it turns out, creating a significant headwind. The House, I take what Paul Ryan is saying very seriously, because I don't think he's someone to be flustered when it comes to the numbers. We've said time and time again what an extraordinary occurrence it was, the extent to which conservatives, Republicans, swept state legislatures and governor's offices in 14 and 12. I mean, all of the success of the past three cycles, at least at the legislative level, has been just astonishing. What we're seeing is that there is such drag at the top of the ticket that all of those gains are in danger. Again, you know, probably not going to be, you know, overturned. Again, as you say, Greg, that would be a perfect storm. But the fact that they're all in danger is just an extraordinary reversal. And I don't think you can avoid attributing that to the guy at the top.
A couple of things here to note, Ian. First of all, the vast majority of governor's races are not in presidential election years, so that is a good thing for Republicans. I think 35 or 36 of them are in the midterm election cycle. So those seats obviously won't be vulnerable this year. For those people, of course, who don't like to see either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton as president, I'd like to once again share the wisdom of a recent speaker who gave some advice on this topic.
And to those listening, please don't stay home in November. If you love our country and love your children as much as I know that you do, stand and speak and vote your conscience. Vote for candidates up and down the ticket who you trust to defend our freedom and to be faithful to the Constitution.
I think that's the best advice we can give, right, Ian?
Yeah, you heard all those people cheering at the advice. They were so excited by it. So.
On to the crazy martini now. And no, we're not done with Donald Trump. Donald Trump, ever since, I believe, late Wednesday and then all day Thursday, has basically been going around talking about how Barack Obama founded ISIS. Hillary Clinton's a co-founder of ISIS, and they're both MVPs, and maybe she's the MVP, depending on the speech, for ISIS. And the liberal media and even the Clinton campaign jumping on that. CNN had these chyrons on the bottom of the screen saying, Trump, Obama founded ISIS, and then in parentheses, he didn't. Just to let people know on the technical side of things. But even most people who don't like Trump were out there thinking, okay, well, we know what he means. You know, he didn't really think that Obama got together with al-Baghdadi and signed some paperwork in Raqqa. He's just pointing out that Obama's failed policies have led to this. And that's the exact same point that Hugh Hewitt tried to make with Trump on his radio show on Thursday. But he didn't exactly get the response he was hoping for. Here's part one.
Last night, you said the president was the founder of ISIS. I know what you meant. You meant that he created the vacuum. He lost the peace.
No, I meant he's the founder of ISIS. I do. He's the most valuable player. I give him the most valuable player award. I give her, too, by the way.
But he's not sympathetic to them. He hates them. He's trying to kill them.
He was the founder. The way he got out of Iraq was the founding of ISIS.
And so then Hewitt says, well, aren't you worried about now how you're getting hit over this by continuing to use that exact language? Wouldn't it be more precise to talk about the impact he's actually had on the rise of ISIS? And here's the next exchange.
You do not like that?
I don't. I think I would say they lost the peace. They created the Libyan vacuum. They created the vacuum into which ISIS came, but they didn't create ISIS. That's what I would say.
Well,
but
I disagree.
All right, that's okay.
I mean, with his bad policies, that's why ISIS came about.
That's
true. If he would have done things properly, you wouldn't have had
that's
ISIS.
True.
Therefore, he was the founder of ISIS.
I think maybe he doesn't know what the word founder means. But then this morning, after all that defense of his initial statement, Trump tweets out, ratings challenge CNN reports so seriously that I call President Obama and Clinton the founder of ISIS and MVP. All caps. They don't get sarcasm? Ian, I'm sure Sean Hannity will have the full explanation for us all tonight on what exactly happened here. But what do you make of this little exchange over the past couple days?
Well, Sean will have the one take, and then for a different point of view, he'll bring on Laura Ingraham, as he's been doing the last couple nights. This dovetails nicely with our bad martini. I mean, why, in part, is Trump dragging down the ballot? Because he's completely erratic. He's wildly unpredictable and totally unbelievable. And I know for a lot of people, the erratic behavior, the lying, etc., it's all priced in. You know, they've signed onto it and they'll accept it because of the Supreme Court and all of the other different justifications and the rest. But Trump can't win a presidential election with 40% of the vote, barring extraordinary circumstances. He needs to win these independent voters in Virginia and North Carolina and Colorado and Florida and Ohio and Pennsylvania. And you know, you can run down the list. You can't win a presidential election on the basis of Alabama and Utah, and he might not win one of those.
So this is what's extraordinary. And I think to sort of go back to what we were saying yesterday, this is not the stuff you say if you want to win. If you're genuinely committed to turning some of those voters your way, to converting them to your ticket, you don't say this nonsense. And then when you see the snap polls or the focus groups respond overwhelmingly negatively, for instance, in the Khan controversy a couple weeks back, when you see those polls and then flip a switch and suddenly say, oh, no, that thing I said was literal, I meant was figurative, you don't win anything like that. Among reasonable thinking people, they just look at you and say, you're nuts. So everyone, you know, down ballot is having to defend this kind of thing. And all of the Trump surrogates are having to pretend that this saying, you know, no, he's the literal founder of ISIS, JK guys, they have to, you know, pretend that this is somehow message discipline and that it's not going to be the case for 4 years in the White House. I mean, we've beat this drum for months and months and months about how untrustworthy and frustratingly, alarmingly unpredictable Donald Trump is. How much more can you really say about it? But the fact is there are consequences for this. And it's not just going to be his race at the top of the ticket, which a victory in which looks increasingly more far-fetched. New polls show Hillary has a double-digit lead in Virginia, Colorado, and a significant lead in North Carolina. But it's going to damage all the down-ballot races as well, as we just discussed. So it's truly extraordinary. You can't wrap your mind around Hugh Hewitt saying, please, please take this rope. Please, please, please don't hang yourself with it. And Trump doing exactly that. I mean, it's truly astonishing.
Yeah, and it's not just this issue, obviously, because obviously there is an endless list of Obama administration failures and Hillary Clinton failures as Secretary of State, including how they pulled U.S. forces out of Iraq, no status of forces agreement, and allowing that vacuum to exist. It's a powerful issue because it shows how poor this administration has been on national security and how desperately we need a change in policy on the world stage, and particularly in some of these international hotspots. And every time Trump addresses one of these issues that should be, like you said earlier in the week, a softball over the plate, he somehow finds a way to completely screw it up and make himself look even worse.
And let's just take a quick trip backward in the time machine, Craig, to recall that the beginning of this week was supposed to be, you know, the pivotiest pivot yet with Trump's substantive presidential economic speech.
Right.
That feels like a year ago because we've spent the whole time litigating all these insane comments, this and the Second Amendment comment and all the rest. So, look, I mean, I was on a different program with the Trump campaign chairman from Virginia, and he was saying, you know, we have this saying in the campaign, let Donald be Donald. That's part of the problem, and I think the Virginia polls are making that clear.
He never misses an opportunity to miss an opportunity. that's probably the best way to succinctly wrap that up. But Ian, we can't leave the week like this. It's just too distasteful. We got to send people into the weekend with a little bit of hope and encouragement. So here you go. Yes, there are still a myriad of problems with Rio. Those have been underdocumented, to say the least. But when it comes to the actual competition at the Summer Olympic Games in Rio, the Americans are doing a bang-up job. We are dominating the pool. Michael Phelps won his fourth gold medal on Thursday night. Hopefully tonight he'll add his fifth in the 100-meter butterfly. He won the 200 individual medley for the fourth consecutive Olympics. Nobody's ever done that before. Our women's gymnastics team is amazing. They won by a massive margin in the team competition. We took gold and silver in the women's all-around. We're doing well in a lot of different team sports, from beach volleyball to regular volleyball to basketball. We're just very, very strong, and we're seeing the best of American hard work, effort, competition, the desire to be the best. The meritocracy that made this country great, Ian, is on display. In the Olympics, you don't get a medal just for showing up.
There's no starker demonstration, perhaps, of the fact that the United States does not need a ministry of sport, the government to be guiding our sports programs, et cetera, than the Olympics. It's just an extraordinary display. It seems like every go-round, every 2 years, summer and winter, it's always amazing to watch
these extraordinarily young, depressingly young athletes do what they do. Just on the subject of Michael Phelps, who's not young by Olympic standards, I believe he took his 22nd gold medal cumulatively last night.
Correct.
And I was trying to think, is there anyone in any sport, I guess you'd have to say individual sports, who has been as dominant as he has? Maybe Tiger Woods at the peak of his game in golf, but I mean, it's just, he's absolutely extraordinary. Phelps is a true marvel.
Yeah, somebody needs to do some research on how many countries all time he has more medals than, because I think it's a fairly
most.
It's a fairly long list, and we should point out a bunch of others. Katie Ledecky's had a great Olympics. Simone Manuel won gold last night in one of the women's swimming events. So it's just from top to bottom, Phelps is obviously the headliner, and just what he's been able to do over five Olympics now is staggering. But American accomplishment, American achievement on full display, and at a time like this, I can't think of something that would we can appreciate more than this during this ridiculous political season.
It's a nice break. There's no question about that.
Hopefully we can do the same in track and field and beyond. Ian, thank you so much for subbing for Jim this week. We'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. Jim will be back on Monday. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Join us then for the next 3 Martini Lunch.